and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And it's another week, it's another bit of history, and Jem, we're going to be really quick and efficient this week. We're going to make sure that this podcast doesn't take any longer than it has to. We're going to make sure... I've just realised I've wasted so much time saying how quick and efficient we're going to be, Jim. Do you want to just start on the topic?
Right, okay. A while back, we did castles and forts, and we seemed to get a bit of love to do with that. So, as we said at the time, there are so many things we can do around it. So I figured let's do an episode on sieges, because I think there is nothing more epic than a good old siege. However, what's really interesting is under modern day laws, this is after the Geneva Convention, it's to do more with like the International Criminal Court and in The Hague, that sieges now are technically a war crime on the grounds that they disproportionately affect a civilian population. Now, that would be a bit different if we're talking literally about a castle or fort, but what I find interesting is so many famous sieges aren't to do with specifically a little castle or fort, but more to do with fortified towns. And, you know, even if you go up to as late as World War II, you've got two of the, well, the Battle of Stalingrad is the largest battle in human history, and it was around basically a siege of a city, Stalingrad. And then there was the siege of Leningrad, commonly referred to as the 900 days. I guess, spoiler alert, that gives you an idea how long it was. But the idea is, you know, more than 2.5 years, an entire modern city was surrounded by enemy forces and tried to starve into submission. So you can see there, you are talking about hundreds of thousands of people suffering starvation through war. You can get why it might be considered a war crime, but I'm a little uncomfortable with that as a concept, because it does seem to imply that it's a standard military tactic. It isn't unusually cruel or unusual throughout history. So if you're saying it's a war crime, that means the Duke of Wellington's a war criminal, you know, Alexander the Great's a war criminal, Julius Caesar's a war criminal. It's like, I'm not entirely sure we should put everybody who ever committed a siege under the bracket war criminal. But that's my opening thoughts, both good and bad. What about you, Greg?
I got one question, and then I'm going to carry on with the comment, just because it's purely out of interest. Do you happen to know if their definition of a siege in terms of war crimes would expand to cover a blockade? Because a blockade is essentially...
Well, if we're going to use the siege of Leningrad was... yes, there was artillery going on, but more than anything else, it was trying to starve the population into submission. So, that is a blockade by another name, of course. So, and I guess during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because sieges are considered an actual attack, a violation, and blockades also, can be seen as a sort of political attack. So during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were very careful not to call it either of those things. I think they were using the term quarantine, which is a medical term. I mean, it's still stopping people coming in, but, it's... simple answer is I don't know. I'm not an expert on international criminal law, but I would imagine if somebody was carrying out a siege but calling it a blockade, then yes, a blockade would be a war crime.
Now, and here's where I fall apart with using the idea of a siege as a war crime, even if it's, you know, on a city or anything else. But let's take the old days of castles. If I surround a castle, then obviously the people are going to starve. But very often, the option was given for, you know, sort of innocent people to leave if they wanted. And in fact, a lot of the time, the defenders wanted people to, you know, they wanted a certain number of the people to just leave and escape, because that would destroy morale within inside the castle. And I know that we have situations, I believe we have Richard the Lionheart himself doing it, where... they did say, okay, we'll let the women and children go. And the women and children were let out, and then they began slaughtering them until the siege ended. Now, that obviously is a war crime. That's a different thing.
I don't think you can put that one on Richard. Well, Richard did slaughter prisoners, but they were all male prisoners.
Right, okay, so there are examples of that happening. Now, the thing is that what you're actually doing when you besiege a castle is you are essentially giving the people inside an option: surrender or starve to death. Okay, that's basically the options that you're trying to present to these people. Whereas in a modern warfare setting, if I besiege, you know, and we have sieges, they refer to it as a siege sometimes in the newspaper when we have a hostage situation. You know, you say we are, you know, there is a siege of wherever it is, the embassy, whatever the situation is. They say they're under siege. Well, here's the thing. If we, you know, me and you, Jem, we decide to besiege a castle in the 1400s, that's because our options are fairly limited. You know, with the people starve to death or they come out. Now, today, if we decide to besiege a fort, our options are also, let's not forget, option number one, they surrender. Option number two, they starve to death. We also have option number three, drop a bomb on them. And in that point in time, I think the give them the option to give up is probably slightly fairer than the option of just drop a bomb on them and kill everybody in the city in an instant. So that's where my sort of initial problem comes with calling a siege a war crime.
Well, we're not going to get too hung up on that one, because let's talk about some nice juicy sieges and, you know, some epic stories rather than, because we did a two-parter on war crimes a while back. If you want to listen to our thoughts on that very serious subject, we didn't in any way denigrate it or diminish it. Do have a listen back. I'm not quite sure where it is, but just scroll through the feed, you'll find it somewhere. But going back to sieges, you're talking about the sort of starvation thing, you can absolutely see the appeal, because from the point of view of the attackers, I don't lose any men. All I'm doing is losing time. And, you know, I may or may not be able to hit the people in beyond those walls with my catapults or trebuchets, but I absolutely know hunger will get them. And I guess a bit like when we were talking about the summer campaigning, a lot of these sieges or the final attacks were after perhaps months of being assaulted, shot at, with food supplies very much dwindling. These people, the defenders, were not in their physical prime. They were very much diminished. And you know, then it just sort of tells the tale, if you like, of the bravery of some of these last stands, that they were starving, hungry, incredibly tired, and yet they were still willing to sort of fight for days as the final throes of X town, fort, etc. fell to whoever. I think one of the good examples of how siege technology evolved is the Ottomans. Now, a lot of people call them the Turks, and I find that interesting, because you've either got the Westerners just lumping all these communities together and calling them Turks, which is wrong, or you now get the modern day Republic of Turkey lumping together these disparate groups and saying they're all Turks, and they're wrong too. In the early eras, nobody was called Turks. They were just Ottomans, although some of them might have been Greek Ottomans or Turkic Ottomans or Anatolian Ottomans anyway. But in the very, very, very early era of it, the first guy, the whole Ottoman Empire is named after the same family. They never changed dynasty, unlike the Tudors, but anyway. And it was named after the first guy, who's actually called Osman, but it can be translated as Ottoman. But the point is, he was a horse archer, and he had a small army, and that can't possibly capture a city. They didn't have any siege craft whatsoever. So unfortunately, the name eludes me right now, but the first major walled city that they tried to capture, the only option was to starve out the local population. And they did it for 9 years. So we're talking about roughly sort of 1320-ish here. We're at the very beginnings of the Ottoman Empire. It wasn't really an empire then, but you know, it took them 9 years to eventually grind down the Byzantine forces of this town to capitulate. But fast forwarding 130 years, and in 1453 we get the siege of Constantinople, where we now have an empire in its prime that has learnt how to do siege craft. And this is the time when this is the first key battle decided by gunpowder, as Mehmet II, Mehmet the Conqueror, he fires his cannons, captures Constantinople, which has withstood more than a dozen serious sieges prior to the Ottomans. So you can see an evolution just in one civilization from, we're just going to have to wait outside the walls till they give up, to we have the technology to break down the walls, to break in there. And indeed, that siege lasted, I think, about 2 months compared to 9 years. So they had made some pretty big progress over a century plus change.
I think that is one of the things, because sieges get broken in various different ways. But once you actually start attacking, blowing up walls and things. I think you're moving away from a siege mentality. Of course, one of the things that really did sort of begin to develop, and I don't want to take us back to the whole question of war crimes again, but one of the things that did obviously develop as part of siege mentality was what is arguably the beginnings of biological warfare. Because one of the things that obviously a lot of people do to, if you can make the people in that besieged area ill, especially going back to the medieval times, then you're going to find it much, much easier to break the siege. They are going to have to... And so we do get situations where if they're bringing their water from a single well within that particular castle, let's say we're besieging castle, if they're using a well to get their water from, then by dropping animal carcasses, things like that, anything that's going to rot that water, anything that's going to turn that water bad, you straight away give yourself an advantage. And, you know, I think that is one way in which sieges do build up towards this rather horrible idea. You know, we get this idea of, you know, the people sitting around out on the outside, the people sitting inside, both waiting for the other one to make the work, you know, to do something, both waiting to see what happens. And yet we have this situation where they were often desperately trying to get the besiegers to give up and using tactics that really were underhand, I think, when it comes down to sort of poisoning water sources.
Yeah, well, that's if they could poison the water sources, but, you know, chucking diseased bodies over walls with their catapults and trebuchets. There was a Mongol warlord in the 14th century called Janabeg, and he was trying to capture, I believe it was Genoese, not Venetian, but it was an Italian trading outpost on the edges of the Black Sea. It was called a town called Kaffa, and he was trying to besiege it. He was trying to attack it, but his troops fell dangerously ill with this weird illness, and suddenly he was watching his army die before his eyes. So he got so annoyed, he chucked the bodies with the catapults, diseased bodies, over into Kaffa. So imagine the sort of sound of bodies raining down on ceilings and stuff like this, and smashing all over, and obviously spreading the infection. And this was the year 1345, I'm pretty sure. And what happened is that the everybody was getting sick in Kaffa, so they got on ships and headed west. And that's how the Black Death got into Europe. So we can all thank Janabeg. I once did an article going, Janabeg's catapults were the most lethal weapons in history because they spread Black Death, and it's between a third and half of Europe's population died because of this attempt to biological warfare. Although at the time it seems to be more of a gigantic hissy fit than specifically biological warfare. But an era that I know you like, the English Civil War, I remember reading once an article, because really there is a science to a siege. Yes, there is a sort of skill and strategy to a battle, but always like Sun Tzu's argument that a battle won is just making fewer mistakes than the enemy, because there's so much confusion on a battlefield. You know, sometimes it's more luck than judgment that wins the day. But with a siege, you've got the sort of the people undermining the walls, you've got the catapults or cannons, you've got all this different technology and engineering going on. Siege towers, they were a real thing. I mean, it kind of looks like they're surely only in Lord of the Rings, but no, they were a real thing. But it was all about trying to get at the people behind these thick, thick walls. And I always like this one, that during a minor siege during the English Civil War, I don't know which side was besieging which, but some genius came up with the idea of getting bales of hay and twigs, drenching them with arsenic, and then setting fire to them, and then making sure that they did it when the prevailing wind was going to pour this poisonous smoke over the castle to try and kill everybody inside. So we think of poison gas as something that could only have possibly happened in World War One onwards, but that is a Stuart era attempt at poison gas warfare.
Let's not forget, though, that one of the big things when you're besieging castle, I mean, first of all, I'm trying to move everything really quickly because I know we're short on time and I know this is a huge topic. We're already on really part two of our siege discussions. The first thing is, I think you've got to look, there are two different types of siege. One is a type of siege where the people inside that castle or whatever, they are you know, it's their last bastion of hope, as it were. They're going to sit out the siege. They're hoping that eventually the attackers will give up or similar, you know. Or you've got the other type of siege. Now, sometimes, of course, the attackers didn't have forever. Because the besieged castle, if you're part of a larger effort, then the people surrounding the castle, obviously, they've got to be watching out for other parts of armies coming along to join the attack as well. So very often a castle under siege was waiting, was trying to hold out until reinforcements, until another army, another unit could arrive and help the attack. Presumably there is therefore going to be a big difference in the strategy for the attackers, whether or not they're prepared to just sit there, camp it out and wait.
There are many instances in medieval warfare where basically, I mean, this is the thing, you see these amazing castles, these incredibly intricate defenses of a fort or whatever, and you think, well, how's anybody going to get past that? And in a way, that was the point. They were meant to be intimidating. They're meant to say to people, do you really want to try this? Because then it led to every reason to try both, to get both sides to sit down and talk. And there are loads of instances where basically the two sides come out and talk to each other. And the basic agreement was, look, our army could break down these walls, but it's going to take a long time. It's going to be really expensive. We're going to lose lots of lives. We don't want to do this. Also, the other thing is we want to capture that castle intact. We don't want to spend a fortune rebuilding its walls after we've knocked them down again. So you put all that together, there's every reason for both sides to talk. So the agreement was basically, okay, well, we expect to have a relief force with us by, let's say, June the 20th. So, you know, we'll basically be at an uneasy truce until then. We won't get any more food into our place, but you're not allowed to attack us. So will everyone just sort of sit there in limbo till June 20th? Now, if the relief force turns up on June 20th, you have to go away. But if it doesn't turn up, we will give you the castle. And that happened quite a lot, more often than you may think. So we only remember the sieges. It's a bit like the newspapers. Everybody's really worried about X and Y in the newspapers, not going to try and start scaring people. But the thing that's worth remembering about news is it's unusual. If every day X happened, it would never hit the newspapers. So you get this very distorted view of the world. It's the world is not quite as terrifying as the news would have you believe. They just tell you what's the unusual stuff. And it's the same thing with sieges. They're remembered because actually they're quite unusual.
I think that's right. And just my last big point, I think, that I'm going to have about sieges, and particularly the way the siege is defeated. Now, you've discussed their negotiation, and I think when we think of a siege, and you know we're trying to talk about it, and we're trying to big up the drama of a siege, you know we're all thinking, oh, it's got to come down to the battle, and we think of, you know, the tunneling under walls and trying to break the siege, like you say, the great big siege towers and things like that, all these different ways that they try and actually break the siege. But as you say, one way that the siege would be broken would be a simple negotiation. We've got more friends turning up. If they don't arrive, we're in trouble. If they do, then you might as well just leave. But of course, there's also the fact that every individual person in that castle is, you know, is a human being with all the faults of humanity. So you don't actually have to get the entire castle to surrender, and you don't actually have to blow up a wall of a castle in order to be able to break the siege if you're on the outside. All you actually have to do is to get one person to open up the doors. You only have to get one person to let it go. And I mean, we have examples of propaganda. Even as recently as sort of modern sieges, you get examples of planes flying over and dropping not bombs, but leaflets telling people basically give up, you know, somebody give up. But when we're in a world of castles, one person can really make the difference. And the example that sprung to my mind and got me thinking about this was, of course, my old favourite Sudley Castle, which, while I'm mentioning it, I will point out, every Wednesday over the 6 week summer holiday, you can come along and see me performing at Sudley Castle. But
that counts as your plug, Greg, okay?
And that's my plug quote for the day. But the thing is that they were under siege, as we were talking about earlier, in the Civil War, they were under siege. They were siding with the king. They were besieged by the parliamentarian people. And, I mean, one of the great stories is there is that at one point in time, one of the gunners from the Sudley Castle Tower stuck his head out the window at the wrong time and found himself facing a cannonball. Which, you know, lovely story like that. But the fact of the matter is this siege could have gone on and on and on, and we don't know how it would have gone, except for the fact that they had one man, one of the lieutenants from the castle, defected. He decided he was going to leave the castle. He took whatever offer he was given by the parliamentarian troops, and he opened the gates. And as soon as that gate was opened, the siege was broken. There was no need for them to climb the walls. There was no need to break down all the defences of the castle. All the things that make a castle so strong and so can be immediately overwritten if one person on the inside decides they're just going to open the gates. And I think that's the important thing with sieges is it's a lot more, I think, when I think of a siege, I think of it as a lot more psychological warfare in a lot of ways than it is actually about fighting, combat, blowing up walls.
Yeah, I mean, those are the cool angles of it. I think perhaps the most famous example of somebody just letting them in was the siege of Antioch in the First Crusade. The Crusaders just could not crack this place. They've been besieging it for about a year. Everybody, both the Crusaders and the people internally, were starving. And then eventually somebody let them in. Now, there's kind of discussion as to why that was. Some people think that he might have been just found guilty for hoarding food, which during a siege is punishable by death. So therefore, it's a case of, well, I better let these guys in because they're more likely to keep me alive than the people inside. Or it might just have been a simple bribe. We don't know. But that's perhaps the most famous example of that. You're absolutely right. But Greg, I'm just going to finish off with my last little fact. Do you know how long the longest continual? There are sieges that lasted longer than this, only one or two, but you know, there were breaks in it. But this is continual sieging of a place. Any idea how long we're talking about?
I vaguely think I do. Was there not one that was, oh no, I'm thinking of something different, because I'm thinking of something that goes on 300 or so years. I'm gonna guess about sort of 20 years or so.
You are very, very closer. 21 years. The Siege of Candia, which went from 1648 to 1669. Got to do the maths there. Candia was the capital city of Crete, the island of Crete. And this was a fight between the Venetians and the Ottomans. And basically, there were huge amounts of naval battles as they both sides were trying to get troops or supplies to the city. And it was one of these things. It lasted so long. It went way beyond any sign of importance. And it just became a symbol. It's like, well, if the Ottomans can't crack Candia, they're not what they used to be. Or if the Venetians can't hold Candia, they're not what they used to be. So if you like, the entire national reputation hung on this. It was a prize that no side could afford to lose, but the Ottomans eventually won. And apparently, when the Pope heard of this, he died. There's a lot of stories about when popes heard bad news, they died or lapsed into a coma. This is just one of the many. Maybe we should do an episode of when popes hear bad news. I don't know. But yeah, so that's just, you know, that means if somebody was born at the start of this siege, they would have been 21 years. All they would have known throughout their entire life was a siege.
So that's Gem's episode suggestion. Connect history gems when popes hear bad news and die. Okay, now we'll leave that one there. Do you have anything more to wrap up this topic before we move on to your plug?
No, but you know what? I'm going to pass my plug back over to you. We talked a fair bit about my books recently, but I know this is, we're in summer, your busiest season. So what can people do?
People go to condensedhistories.com. If you go to condensedhistories.com/gems, that is where you will find the links to all of Gem's books and all of my book. And also, if you go to the tour diary there, you can find out all the places you can come along and actually see some of my shows over the summer. If you want to see me talking the same sort of nonsense that I do at the podcast, but also on top of that, get to see me throwing stuff in the air as well.
It's a
must-see,
people.
I really ought to work on my marketing, really.
Yeah. Watch Greg hold things, sometimes throw things, and talk.
And that is all from us this week. We're going to wrap up really quickly. So thank you all for listening. Please take the time to go to iTunes and, you know, leave us a review or anywhere you're listening to this podcast. Please, I'll tell you what, if everybody that downloads this episode tells one other person about it and gets them to download us, then our numbers will shoot up and up and up and up and up forever. So please, make sure you keep spreading the word. But thank you so much for listening. Our numbers do keep going up. And so me and Gem are both incredibly grateful. But for now, thank you so much to my co-host, Mr. Gem Deducci.
And thank you so much to my co-host, Greg Chapman.
And that's all we have time for today. So goodbye and take care.